Educational service to the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally, 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on trade secrets, facts that you're not supposed to know when we come back. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, it was negotiated by Moses, not at Mount Sinai. You and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits, benefits such as rain in due season and multiplied gold and silver and herds and flocks and great wealth. Well, President Bush said that what Americans wanted, though, was jobs, jobs, jobs. But, you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, and God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution or our Bill of Rights or the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land. It's measured in cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. Real wealth isn't measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales, not in public business or jobs, jobs, jobs. Now it's time that you ended this nonsense and cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the Old Covenant contract and collect those benefits now in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD Home School for Adults and then order the free General Law CD package at the same time. After all, it's free. It's a four-hour commentary on the law. It's informative. It's entertaining. It's educational. And it's free of charge. You can call that right now and order yours. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the IRS as it relates to trade secrets. Your Internal Revenue Service has some trade secrets that they don't want you to know about. In fact, in the book, Trade Secrets, Facts That You're Not Supposed to Know, it's the biggest chapter in there with 55 things, 55 points, and I thought, well, since it's the biggest, I'd start this program and I'll give you three or four more of them. I can't cover all of them. It's a dynamite book. You can order it probably from Barnes & Noble. That's where we got ours, Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com. Remember, Trade Secrets, Facts That You're Not Supposed to Know. And it comes from Boardrooms Incorporated. That's all that's in the book, just Boardrooms Incorporated, 196 pages, copyrighted back in 1996. How to Beat the IRS at Its Own Game. That was a neat subchapter in here in the chapter on the IRS. How to Beat the IRS at Its Own Game. People at the IRS choose their words carefully. They choose their words carefully when they want you to help them make a better case against you. You get that? When the IRS agent wants to help you put your foot in your mouth and hang yourself, he chooses his words carefully. And they choose words that intimidate you, convince you, or cajole you into doing something that you otherwise wouldn't do. Now, if you want to beat the IRS at this game, then you must know what the agents mean when they talk tough. And you must know what to expect if you call their bluff. Now, here are some examples. In game one, an IRS agent asks you to produce all of your books and records for a tax examination. Now, more often than not, the agent doesn't want every single record you maintain. He may only be interested in your bank statements or in one or two unusually large items that you deducted on your tax return. Now, respond to the agent's request for all of your books and records by simply asking exactly which records do you want, or what items are you really interested in checking. Now, the chances are he'll tell you, and it won't be every record that you kept for the entire year. Game two. The official line at the IRS is that agents do not negotiate proposed audit adjustments, but in real life, everything is subject to discussion. And many agents will try to bulldoze their way through a case by taking a position, and then they won't budge from it. They will come right out and tell you that they do not bargain. But what they really mean is that they will not bargain unless they have to. I won't bargain unless I have to. If they feel they have a chance of closing the case on an agreed basis, you and the IRS agree on the extra tax owed, they will, because they become more receptive to your proposals. So here's the lesson. Be persistent. and this will give you an excellent chance of meeting the agent on some reasonable middle ground. Game three. You're in the middle of an audit, and the agent asks you to supply him with a copy of the tax return that you filed in a prior year. Perhaps the agent wants to review it to determine if it contains anything worth looking into in greater depth. Now, technically, you don't have to supply it since the IRS already has a copy in its possession. The problem, however, which the agent generally fails to tell the taxpayer, is that it takes forever for an agent to get a copy of that prior tax return through his normal IRS channel. So if you don't supply a copy, most agents won't bother to pursue the matter. So here's a suggestion. Make a deal with the agent to let him see a copy of the tax return only after you're satisfied that the audit has been concluded. Game four. Revenue officers who are in the final stages of preparing for a seizure of a taxpayer's home or business will generally request consent from the taxpayer. This consent allows the IRS to enter private premises for purposes of conducting the seizure, but there are some complications. What the revenue officer usually neglects to tell the taxpayer is that if consent is not given, then the IRS must go through the trouble of obtaining a court order authorizing the seizure, and this can take up to 6 weeks. Sometimes it can take up to 6 months. And taxpayers who refuse to give their consent can use this time to make a last-ditch effort to raise the money they need to pay the outstanding tax bill. 6 weeks to 6 months. In any event, let me back up and run through a little arithmetic. Let's suppose the IRS is about to seize your home. And you're going to be out in the street, or you're going to have to pay a lot of extra money to get moved. If you could stay in that house for 6 weeks to 6 months, you know, that's dollars in your pocket. So tuck that one away in your heart. I thought I'd share that one with you. Game five. Special agents handling criminal investigations often approach people that they suspect of wrongdoing, and then they try to solicit incriminating information from them. If the people are reluctant to cooperate, the special agent will usually explain that if they don't answer the questions now, the agent will have no choice but to serve a summons, and the questions will have to be answered down at his office. Privileged information. This is not 100% true. You can always claim your Fifth Amendment rights by refusing to answer any questions on the grounds that any answers that you give might incriminate you. Taking the Fifth doesn't give a special agent any ammunition that can be used against you in court later on. Everybody has a right to remain silent. That's why I've explained time and time again that the best course of action is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and then shut up. Anything that you want to tell the agent today, you can tell him in court 6 months or a year from now. Here's a couple of three more of these neat little pieces of information in the section on the IRS. Here's who the IRS is after. It's called the IRS hit list. First, they're after illegal tax protest. The IRS will go after a tax protester for as little as $25 in unpaid taxes. And that's just to set an example. Anyone who refuses to file a completed return arguing against the constitutionality of taxes or the way the country is being run will be labeled a tax protester and be charged a $500 penalty for filing a frivolous return. Or he may be given penalties and interest for unpaid taxes. Now, the second that they're looking for are called abusive tax shelters. The IRS is looking for large loss items, usually under charitable contributions on Schedule A, partnerships on Schedule E, and investment losses on Schedule D. And then third, they're looking for unreported income. The IRS estimates that most of its tax collection losses stem from non-reported income rather than excessive deductions. So make sure that you properly report all of your dividends, interest, profits, and losses from securities transactions, and of course wages on your return. The IRS is checking what you report against what the people who pay you report. So if you get a 1099 from somebody that says that they paid you $10,000, you better have the $10,000 on your return, because what happens is when that 1099 goes through the computer and your tax return goes through the computer and they report $10,000 and you don't report anything, that's a red flag and says, hey, listen, we got to go check this out. Wouldn't you be better off working for somebody that doesn't give you a 1099? Called working under the table. All right, let's see if we got another one over here. It's just full of little neat stories, like protecting life insurance from IRS liens. You know, you get a life insurance settlement, but you got a lien, and you're going to collect this life insurance, and there's a lien against the proceeds, and you want to protect it. Divorce and separation tax loopholes. Your husband divorced you and left you to pay all the taxes. Hide assets from the IRS and do it legally. Hiding assets from the IRS legally. Well, that's kind of a neat one. Many people keep assets in a safe deposit box thinking that no one will ever find out about it. but the name of the renter of a safe deposit box isn't kept secret. And it doesn't help to rent a box in your own name. There's an organization that for less than $100 will run a search of every bank in the country to see if you are a safe deposit box customer. And the IRS, if it's looking for assets of yours, will do a bank search for safe deposit boxes held in your name. So it's especially easy for the IRS to track down safe deposit boxes that you pay for with a personal check. It simply goes through your canceled checks. Now, if you want to conceal the existence of a safe deposit box and do it legally, then you go to your attorney and you ask your lawyer to set up a nominee corporation. And it's a corporation that has no other function but to stand in your place for the purposes that you designate, such as to rent a safe deposit box. So you rent a box in the name of the corporation and pay for it in cash. Your name and signature will be on the bank signature card, but the corporation, not you, will be listed as the box's owner on the bank's records. And because you paid cash, there'll be nothing in your records to connect you with the box. You can, if you want to, name another person as signatory in addition to yourself. Then if something happens to you, that person will be able to get into the box, such as your wife or your mother or dad or somebody else. And there's additional protection. Having a safe deposit box in a corporation's names permits the box to be opened by your survivors without having the box sealed by the state or the bank upon notification of your death. Otherwise, the survivor must get to the box before the funeral to look for a will and to find whatever else may be in there. So if you've got your will in your safe deposit box, and then the bank finds out that you died, they'll seal the box. Now where are you? All right, that's called a nominee corporation. You know, with a little legal training, you can avoid going to a lawyer every time you need a little job like that done. Opening a corporation is a transaction that you do with your Secretary of State, and there's a form for doing that. I mean, you don't have to go to an attorney and pay him $3,000 to open a corporation or $300 or whatever his fee is. I mean, you can do it yourself. It's just a matter of, do you know how? And, of course, if you don't know how, I guess you got to go hire an attorney. Now, here's a neat little section in here called Use the Accrued Pension. You know, a lot of you people out there have pensions. And you're wondering, well, how can I get my pension money out of that pension? You know, and in some cases, you can't, and in some cases, you can. Well, now, here's a little move for you to make. Employee, go get him, has had it. He's been working for his present boss, and he's done now, and he wants to quit and open his own business. He wants out, and he wants out right now. Now, he has $100,000 coming to him from his employer's qualified plan, and then he's entitled to take that money, and he qualifies for lump sum treatment. So Getem finds out that the tax bite on that $100,000, if it's distributed this year, would be $35,000 or 35%. But he needs $50,000 to finance his new business. Now, what is he going to do? Well, the steps would be as follows. Go Getem forms a new corporation. It's called Go Getem Company. The Go Getem Company adopts a qualified profit-sharing plan. And the distribution, that is the full $100,000 from Go Getem's former employer's qualified plan, is rolled over into the new Go Getem plan. Well, isn't that just real special? Now, number four, the new plan would have a provision to allow loans to be made to participants in an amount not to exceed 50% of the participants' vested interest, or $50,000. The new profit-sharing plan would loan $50,000 to Go Getem to be repaid over 5 years at 11% interest. Now, obviously, the documentation from the new plan itself, the plan administrator's minutes describing the approval of the loan and the note payable by Go Getem to the profit-sharing trust, must be impeccable in every detail. What that means is you have to do your homework and do the paperwork. Now, if the IRS agent comes to your door, here's a neat little piece of information. The IRS has issued new instructions to be followed by auditors making field visits to a taxpayer's home or place of business. And the new rules are this. Agents may enter private premises only when invited in by the rightful occupant. The IRS is concerned about the growing number of taxpayer lawsuits for violation of privacy rights. All right, so that's a neat little piece of information. They've got a new rule now. So don't invite them in if you don't want to talk to the IRS, and tell them to butt out, partner, and shove off. Some excuses that don't work and some excuses that do. A lot of times, you know, people lie when the truth would serve their purpose better. An old adage. Well, that guy would lie when the truth would serve his purpose better. So when dealing with the IRS, there's certain things that, you know, they buy into, and there's certain things that they don't. And knowing which side of the line you're on, you know, can be pretty helpful. So here's some excuses that work and some that don't. Taxpayers who face penalties for misfiling returns or misreporting income will do the best they can to come up with a good explanation. So here are some excuses that work and others that don't. The excuses that work are based upon reliance on bad IRS advice, or reliance from an IRS employee or an IRS publication. If the advice came from an employee, you must show that it was his job to advise taxpayers and that you gave him all of the facts. Second, bad advice from a tax professional can excuse a mistake if you fully disclose the facts to the advisor. You must also show that he was a competent professional experienced in federal tax matters. And then lost or unavailable records will excuse a mistake if the loss wasn't the taxpayer's fault and he makes a genuine attempt to recover or reconstruct those records. And incapacity of a key person can be a legitimate excuse. An example, serious illness of the taxpayer or a death in his immediate family. Now here's some excuses that don't work. Pleading ignorance or misunderstanding of the law generally does not excuse a mistake. There's an exception, though, where a tax expert might have made the same mistake. Someone else slipped up. You are personally responsible for filing your tax return correctly, and you cannot delegate that responsibility to anyone else. If your accountant or your lawyer files late, for example, you pay the penalty. Personal problems don't carry much weight with the IRS. For example, don't expect to avoid a penalty by pleading severe emotional strain brought on by a divorce, or my mom and dad died in a car wreck or something on that order, because they don't care much for those excuses. Now, here's a little section in here I thought I'd share with you, talking about more tax breaks. In addition to tax deferral for investment earnings, annuities offer these tax advantages. Tax break on payouts. When you receive payments from an annuity, only a portion of each payment is taxable to you, and that's because a part of each payment is considered to be a return of your original investment, and thus it's tax-free. The fact that a portion of each payment is tax-free means that the amount of tax that you owe on each payment will be much less than the tax you'd owe on a payment of the same dollar size received from a taxable investment. Now there's a Social Security break, and I put this one in brackets because, as you know, Social Security is the third rail of politics. Anybody that messes with Social Security, you're going to vote him out, right? Well, the Social Security tax break, the new tax law can also make annuities more attractive than alternative investments to many receiving Social Security benefits. Under the new tax law, persons with incomes greater than specified threshold amounts will have 85% of their Social Security benefits subject to income tax. God, your Social Security subject to income tax. Let me explain that one to you. I put two brackets around that one. Social Security is the only annuity program. An annuity is a payment that you receive in retirement. You can have annuities that come from your company, annuities that come from insurance companies. Social Security is an annuity. It's a monthly payment that you receive. Now, all of these annuities are built up. They're created by you. Your annuities from your pension fund, that's paid by you. Social Security, you pay those taxes in. An insurance annuity, you pay those premium. So it comes out of your after-tax income. Now take Social Security. It's worse than after-tax income. They take it right off the top. You never see it. And if you're making $50,000 a year, just to pick a number over here, you're paying in about $5,600 a year in taxes. Then in addition to that, they take $8,500 in income tax. So the income tax is a tax on a tax, because first of all, you paid in somewhere between $56 and $7,600. I think on $50,000 it was $7,600, as I recall now. Without looking it up, $7,600. $35,000 is $5,600, if I remember right. Then they tax the same income, the same $50,000, the 17% for the income tax. So what they're doing is they're charging you 17% of the $7,600 or $76 or $56, whatever the amount is. They charge you 17% of that amount a second time. So they're taxing you twice. You paid it once, and then they come along and they charge you 17% of that whole amount a second time. Now in the case of $50,000 a year, that amounts to $1,300. So they come in here and they rip you off of that $1,300. And I guess it's legal, it's written into the tax code. It sure as hell isn't moral, but it's probably very legal. Now, you pay this money into the Social Security system. So, now, here's what you're going to get back. For every dollar that you pay in, you're going to get somewhere around 20 to 68 cents of it back, depending upon your tax bracket, depending upon, you know, your income level and what you're retiring. Now, understand this. You're not going to get 100% of it back like you do from your retirement program at General Motors, or 102% of it back like you would if you had an annuity from Mutual of Omaha. You're only going to get 20 cents on the dollar, 30 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar, and in the best case scenario, you'll get 68 cents on the dollar back. That's your best case scenario. And then they're going to tax you on it. Now let's just picture this. You pay in $100, and they give you $20 back, and then tax you 17% of the $20 they gave you back. And you people call that the third rail of politics? Oh my God. You know, they talk about the dumbing down of America. You know, they're not just whistling Dixie through a straw hat. You know, anybody that buys into a program like that has to be worse than mindless. Now, the IRS makes mistakes once in a while. Here's one more example of the information here in the book. Computer machines notice. This is the most common IRS mistake. You get a computer-generated automatic tax assessment from the IRS, and it claims that you don't list or didn't list an item of income on your return, and now you owe more taxes. So if you get a computer-generated letter that comes out, let me tell you how this computer-generated letter works. They discovered that I think it's 87% of people who receive these computer-generated letters, when it says you made a mistake and you owe $85 more, if it's under $100, and if you get a letter from the IRS and it says you owe us more taxes because you screwed up on your tax bill, and the amount that you're being done is under $100, they found that 87% of the people that receive those letters will simply write a check and send it in. So the IRS has a quota, and every year they send out, you know, 50 million of those. They'll send them out to every taxpayer, just half the taxpayers, about 50 million taxpayers. And 87% of the 50 million taxpayers who receive that dunning notice by a computer-generated letter for under $100 will sit down, write a check, and send it in. And they generate, let's see if I remember the number, is it $7 billion a year? I think it was $7 billion is the number, $7 or $70 billion, something on that order. Get that? Now, when you get a computer-generated letter that says you owe, you know, $85 or $66.40 or something like that, you ought to take a look at that, because it doesn't have anything to do with your tax return. It has to do with this computer-generated letter that generates billions of dollars of revenue by simply sending you the letter, and you'll respond to it, like sending a letter out, you know, for a charitable contribution, and there's so many people that'll just sit down, write a check, and send it in. So that's why you get those in the mail, because, you know, 4, 5, or 10% of people will send in a charitable donation. The IRS is doing the same thing. Now, isn't that just real special? All right, we're at the midway point. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. In The Law Hour, an editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give out don't necessarily mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on The Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed in whole by The Law Hour editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about The Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. You're listening to The Law Hour and editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives in it that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a book called Trade Secrets, Facts That You're Not Supposed to Know. And there's lots of things that trade, commerce, business, and industry wants to keep from you, that the government or the IRS or the police, you know, everybody wants to keep information away from you, if that information might benefit you at their expense. So you can see why the IRS might not want you to know everything that they know. In the same way, when you go in to buy a new car, the dealer does not want you to know how much he paid for the car when he bought it from Ford Motors. In other words, he's trying to sell you a car for $20,000 that he bought for $10,000. If you knew that, you see, you might only offer him $15,000. So he might try to save some money on the transaction. So he guards that with his life. An insurance company will never let you know what the policy limit is. Policy limit, that is, you have an auto accident. I'm a claims adjuster for the other party. I'm not going to come out and say, okay, well, we're playing for $100,000. We're playing for $2 million. I'm going to keep that away from you. I don't want you to know that. And, of course, your job then is to find out, well, what are the policy limits? How many dollars are we playing for here in the game? Now, when we talk about business and career, how to find top-paying part-time professional jobs and better than summer jobs, summer businesses, the job-sharing alternative, or where to look for these jobs, small business ideas for kids, how to get an enterprise started, sales of summer projects, or some samples, rather, of summer projects that pay money, and the best of the best home businesses. Home businesses. What are some of the best home businesses? You know, more than 20 million Americans now make some or all of their income working from home. And I'm one of those. I commute 47 steps from the breakfast table to my office every day. 47 steps. It's probably the best commute that I've come up with so far. Now, I'm not alone. 20 million Americans now make some or all. Well, now there's only 100 million workers in the country. Yeah, 105 or 110 million, something like that. So about one-fifth, about one person out of every five works at home. And they make some or all of their income from their homes, 20% of us do. Now, here are some of the best home-based businesses for the coming decade. Cleaning service, one of the easiest businesses to start from home, requires willingness to work and to produce superior results. The advantages, there's a low startup and overhead cost, ample customer base, and good potential for growth. Disadvantages, it's relatively low in status, it's hard, dirty work, and you need to hire employees in order to grow. And what's important is to choose a specialty and then stick with it. Examples, windows, the window blinds, swimming pools, chimneys, or air ducts. The startup costs are only $500 in many cases, depending on the area of specialization. And the potential annual earnings are $25,000 to $200,000 a year. Now, there are more and more people who are working, you know, to paycheck households. You got mom out here working. And she doesn't want to come home and have to do all the cleaning, so she's willing to pay someone to come in and do some, if not all, of the cleaning. Businesses also have a need for cleaning, and there's also a need, you know, for doing the yard work. Now, you know, you typically think, well, we'll let the Mexicans do all of that. Well, I don't know. If they can do it, why can't we? And if they can prosper at it, why can't we prosper at it? And so here's a guy that said, hey, wait a minute, you can make up to $200,000 a year in a cleaning business. I'll tell you a story over here. I had a student one time who was in the cleaning business, and he was flat broke in Walnut Creek, California. He went into a Sambo's restaurant back in the 60s. When we still had Sambo's, before Sambo's became politically incorrect. The upshot of it was he was hungry and he was flat broke, and so he went in. And he said to the manager, he said, I'll wash all of your windows if you'll give me a meal and feed me. So the manager looked out and he said, well, yeah, I'll do that. And he took him into the back room, the cleaning room, or janitorial room, and he gave him a squeegee and a bucket and gave him some vinegar and rags. And this guy went out and he washed all of the windows in the Sambo's restaurant, came back and sat down. They put on a big spread for him, and he's sitting there eating, and the manager sat down, and he said, do you know what we pay to have those windows washed? And the guy said, no. He said, well, we pay $75 a week to have those windows washed. And you came in and you washed those windows, and you did a better job than the company that we have that comes in here and washes those at $75 a week. Now, $75 a week, boys and girls, is $300 a month. So here's a restaurant. The restaurant pays $300 a month to have their windows washed once a week. And the manager said to the guy, he said, you know, you look like a guy that wants to work. You got out there and you did a pretty good job. And he said, you know, I can tell you from personal experience that window washers are in short supply here in Walnut Creek anyway. And he said, I would pay you the same $75, and I think I'd probably get a better job, and I just didn't pay you as I would the company that's doing it. It's up to you. And this triggered this guy's brain. He said, well, you're on. I mean, now the guy's going to make $75 a week washing these windows, probably, you know, 3-4 hour job once a week. Could wash them inside and out now, you know, both sides. When you become a window washer, make sure that you bid it in both sides. So he did that. He told the guy he would. And then he said, gee, now I wonder if I could do this for anybody else. So he goes out to a couple other guys and he says, hey, I'd wash your windows here for. And by now he just got the cue, didn't he? The guy at Sambo's told him what these windows are worth. So he just did a little mental arithmetic, walked over to a little store, a shoe store, had one plate glass window, a glass door, and a transom over the windows, three panes of glass, one big one, two little ones. And he said, I'll wash your windows for $10, $10. How long does it take to wash six sides of glass? Well, about 30 minutes. Well, that's $20 an hour. Yeah. Guy said, yes. And you know, the guy in the store, he doesn't want to wash those windows. The guy wants to sell shoes. He does not want to wash windows. Now, if you'll come by once a week or twice a month and you'll wash those windows, make that store look good, and it's worth the $10 to him. And it's worth the $75 to the Sambo's restaurant, you see. And so he went out and developed a customer base. And that launched him on his new career. He went into the window washing business. And he said, you can't get in on these big office buildings. You know, the Kaiser building in downtown Oakland, for instance, you know. They've got big companies that do those windows. What you're looking for is just little mom-and-pop stores on Main Street. Window washing service. So when I saw that in here, you know, this janitorial, I said, aha, that's exactly right. This guy, by the way, ended up with about 25 employees doing all kinds of janitorial services, you know, for banks and you know, the restrooms, you know, and things like, you know, it's dirty work. It's the kind of work that other people don't want to do. And you walk in, you say, I'll do it. And you say, hey, I'm going to charge you $10. I'm going to charge you $20, $30. And you'll figure out how many hours it's going to take you. And you should be making $20, $30 an hour doing it. And nobody, you know, is going to be standing over you watching, you know, it'd take you 17 minutes, you know, to clean that toilet bowl. It's, you know, it'd take you 17 minutes to clean it. And what'd you charge for it? That's all they're interested in. Now, additional information, everything you need to know to start a house cleaning service. Books written on the subject by people that have done it. And I just told you a story. And I just told you how to do that. If it worked for that guy back in 1960, it'll work for you in 2006. There's still glass to be washed and people that don't want to wash it. Mailing list service. You know, create and maintain mailing lists to be sold or rented. It requires a knowledge of computers and the ability to do detailed work accurately and on deadline. Advantages, it's relatively easy to start and sell. It can be run part or full-time or as an adjunct to an existing business, such as bookkeeping, bookkeeping service. The disadvantages, it requires precise attention to detail, and the work is routine and uninspiring. The risk of developing repetitive motion injuries from constant typing. Oh, my God. This is a hazardous business, selling mailing lists, because you have to type. Important. It's a powerful 100 to 200 megabyte computer hard drive. Startup cost $2,500 to $6,000. Potential annual income earnings $25,000 to $75,000 a year. Additional information, books on the subject. Medical transportation service. Transcribed dictated audio tapes concerning individual medical cases for doctors and hospitals. Requires discipline. Excellent listening and typing skills. Ability to do accurate, precise work. The advantages. Rapidly growing field. Steady and recession resistant. Disadvantages. It must be self-disciplined and focused. Demand is for fast turnaround. Must be temperamentally suited to being plugged into a pair of headphones for hours at a time. Possibility of repetitive motion injuries. Important. An understanding of medical diagnostic procedures and terminology, as well as the ability to spell specialized words correctly. Startup cost $36,000. Potential annual earnings $30,000 to $60,000 a year. $30,000 to $60,000 a year. Okay, businesses that you can start for under $500 in here. How to change a job or career after age 40. You know, a lot of people get to be 40 years old. You know, I got a guy here works for me. Came from Aruba. I got to tell you about Joe here for a minute. Guy called me some time ago, maybe a year or two ago. He lived down in Aruba, U.S. citizen. Been down there for a number of years. Got tired of it. And said, I need to get out of here. So he moved up here and he started his own handyman business. And here's a guy, him and his wife, working a little handyman operation here. Self-employed. Actually, he's not self-employed. He doesn't have a social security number, but he's a trader at law on a cash basis and doing quite nicely, dealing in gold and silver coin and working around the neighborhood up here in Porter County in the state. Makes a good living, and it's 10 times better than it was in Aruba, so he tells me. Now, why is it that these immigrants can come from all over the world, kids, from all over the world, and come to the United States, and God, they just make it big? You know, these illegal aliens coming here, they're not complaining about repetitive motion syndrome and low wages. God, they have arrived. This is heaven. They've made it. And I had an old guy one time. His name was Frank Rocha. He said, if you were put back in the Azores, where I came from, that's an island, several islands on the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, owned by Portugal. These are Portuguese people. Now. He said, if you were sent back over there where I came from, he said, you would starve to death. You couldn't make it there, you Americans. He said, but you can take any Portuguese from the Azores or Portugal or Europe, or bring them to the United States, and they'll make it, and they'll make it easy, and they'll make it big every time. And that's because it is so hard, so tough where these people come from. You know, they get over here. You take a guy making $2 a day, he comes to the United States and gets $5 an hour. I mean, that guy's arrived, kids. That guy's arrived. And our expectations here in the United States are so high. Well, I won't work for $5 an hour. You got 300,000 people in this country that are on unemployment insurance every week. I see the report comes in the International Forecaster. It's running around 300,000 a week. There's 2.5 million people unemployed. 300,000 become unemployed every week. 2.5 million people in America unemployed. There isn't a single illegal alien in this country that's unemployed. Not a one. They're all employed. And they're not employed at the expense of the 2.5 million Americans that are on unemployment insurance. That's because they make as much money on unemployment insurance as they would working for minimum wage, so why the hell should they work? We are suffering from terminal lazy syndrome here in America. Terminal lazy syndrome. That's the problem. And there was a time in America, you know, when we used to do all of those menial jobs ourselves. We did those. I see complaints in here from time to time. I'm watching the news, and some farmer, you know, down in the Imperial Valley of California says, hey, listen, you know, we put these ads out, and the Mexicans respond, and the Anglos don't. Anglos don't want to pick lettuce. Well, okay. Okay, well, don't complain about your job being shipped out someplace else. The truth of the matter is that you don't want to work, because if you wanted to work, you'd go to work picking lettuce, if that's what it took to make a living. And then you'd work your way back up to whatever it was you were doing or something similar to it. Now, change is here, and change is going to continue, whether you like it or not. Your jobs are going to be shipped overseas. You are competing, boys and girls, whether you like it or not. You are competing with slave labor in China, Indonesia, and Bangladesh. And you're going to continue to do that. And it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. That's where reality is. And that's why this book, I think, is kind of neat. This section in here on career and business has a lot of neat little stories in here about, you know, how to start a business. In spite of the fact that they shipped your job, you know, when you were working down at the bank as a computer man, they shipped your job off to India. There's jobs here. There's employment opportunities here in America. Not doing what you were doing. And if you don't want to pick lettuce, well, then don't pick lettuce. But, you know, then you've got to be able to do something more intelligent, more constructive. And there's companies out there that will hire and pay you to do certain things. You know, you've got to be smart enough to go out there and skillful enough to go out there and do those other things. Americans used to be able to do that, but they're getting to the point now, you know, where they're suffering from the terminal lazies and they don't want to. The guy loses his job at General Motors. He doesn't want to go out and learn how to use a computer. He wants to cry in his beer about, well, I lost my job at General Motors and they shipped it off to China. Well, okay, I would agree that we ought not to do that, that we'd be better off with tariffs and tell the Chinese to go to hell, but then, you know, that isn't where life's at, and that's not what's going to happen. So how to change a job or career after you're 40 years old. It's a little section here in the book. Remember, this is the book called Trade Secrets, Facts That You're Not Supposed to Know. And these are things that the average guy that's over 40, he doesn't know. He loses his job, and the end of the world has come. I see that every once in a while. Well, who wants to hire a guy 55 years old? Hell, old Joe, the guy from Aruba, is 55 years old. I employ him. I buy his services. He's an independent contractor. He's an independent trader is what he really is. I buy his services, and he sells his services to me and other people around the neighborhood over here. His wife is out selling her services to the people here in the neighborhood. And then those people, you know, they're not complaining about low wages. He's got a house, he's got a roof over his head, making a living, doing quite nicely, thank you. He's not complaining. Now, when you're in your 20s, changing jobs within the same field or even changing to another field is relatively easy, but it gets progressively more difficult after you're 35, and it becomes just about impossible after you get to be 40. Now, the first thing that an over 40 job changer is questioned about is his track record. Employment agencies and personnel people will tell you that your experience and credentials are non-transferable. So unless you stay away from the conventional system, it's almost certain that you'll get absolutely nowhere. I'm going to underline the conventional system, also known as think outside the bun. The conventional system, you know, this is where you go to college and you get trained, you know, and you go out into the marketplace and you go to work for ExxonMobil or whatever. And you do your profession or your trade. You get to be 40 years old, you know, they can replace you. They got everybody going to college now. Now they can replace you with a younger person. And by the time you get to be 40, 50 years old, you know, you're in the top echelons, you know, of management or whatever, and you're making some bucks now. And so they want to replace you. I mean, just be pragmatic about it. You got 10 people working for you. Three of the 10 people that are working for you in the same section or the same job over here are making $10 an hour. Seven of them are making $5 or $6 an hour. And the three guys that are making 10, they've been there for 20 years, and they know how everything in the plant works. But you've also got two or three guys down here at $5 or $6 an hour. They also know how everything in the plant works. And do we want to keep the higher priced guys in here or get rid of them? And, you know, just be intelligent about it. And the answer is we want to get rid of them. You need to understand, you know, all of us need to understand something over here, that employment is not the objective of the employer. An employer is not in business to employ people. Let me repeat that. There isn't a single company, there isn't a single employer anywhere located on planet Earth that is in the business of employing people. He's in the business of producing some good or some service. And he needs people to produce the goods and services. Tom Friedman was on Lair NewsHour last night, and he was talking about his book with Senator Dorgan. Frankly, I think Tom has his head right up his rectal region, but then, you know, that's just my personal opinion. And I think Senator Dorgan, you know, while I despise those socialist politics, but he came up with some pretty good points. Both of them have written a book, you know, about this outsourcing of jobs here in America. And Friedman pointed out that this is the global economy, and like it or lump it, You know, this is where reality is located. We have to compete with the Chinese at slave labor. Dorgan, of course, said, well, no, we ought to close our borders and not do that. I agree with the senator. I think we ought to close our borders and shut the Chinese out. But then, you know, that's neither here nor there. That's not going to happen. So there's been a debate going on in this country over free trade, and Americans have chosen free trade. And this is the results that we're getting from it. And so now we're talking about a book here written about how to change jobs when you get to be 40, 50 years old, you know, and nobody wants to hire you anymore because you cost more than the others. And so they're going to downsize or do something else. And old Henry Kaiser, I think, summed it up with a flair when he said, find a need and fill it. Find a need and fill it. In the conventional system, you can't find that need and fill it. Employers are not there to hire people. Employers are there to produce goods and services. That's the bottom line. And Friedman, he pointed out that they used to have a receptionist there at the New York Times, which has now been replaced with a computer chip. So if we have a receptionist, and the receptionist over here gets paid $10 an hour, and we can replace her with a computer chip that costs us $5,000, we put in the computer and the computer chip to answer the telephones because it's cheaper than hiring this woman or this man or whoever's there acting as receptionist year in, year out. So we automate those jobs. And that's been going on, kids, you know, since Osiris McCormick invented the Reaper, which would harvest more wheat, you know, than 50 men working in the field. It displaced those 50 wheat harvesters, you know, with their scythes. That's life. It's been going on since 1837, and it's going to continue to go on. So this neat book here, Trade Secrets, Facts That You're Not Supposed to Know. I don't know what the price is. I doubt if it's $20. But I rated about a 1 in 20 book, and it's worth all of the $20 or whatever you're going to pay for it. I think you're going to profit from it. If it doesn't make you $100, it probably isn't worth buying the book. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to cut it off right there, and I'll be back talking about this Trade Secrets next time. Let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School or the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Remember that the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Your time's up. We're going to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.